Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So last week we looked at and reviewed two poems on jhana meditation that stress the single importance of using meditation to develop concentration. And it is from a well-concentrated mind that is then able to support the refined mindfulness or right mindfulness that the Buddha teaches. The Buddha teaches a very focused type of mindfulness. And it's a type of mindfulness that relates to the Dhamma and is directly applicable to learning the Dhamma. What I mean here is it's not a conceptual application of hoped for mindfulness, such as it's good to be mindful when you're washing the dishes, or be mindful of your feet when you're walking. Those are all good things. You be mindful when you're driving. Be mindful when you're talking with someone. But those aren't things that we can fabricate unless there's an inner foundation rooted in understanding of why we should be mindfulness. And that's what the Buddha teaches. So the Buddha teaches to be mindful of factors of the Dhamma that lead to awakening. Forcing myself to be mindful when I'm washing the dishes does nothing to develop that if I don't have the foundation that the Buddha teaches, the foundation of the Eightfold Path. This is from the Pamadavaharan Sutta. And it's a sutta on refined mindfulness, as the Buddha teaches. The Buddha's words: friends, pay close attention, and I will teach you about one who dwells in mindlessness and one who dwells in mindfulness. So even during the Buddha's time, there was confusion about what is proper mindfulness or right mindfulness, and anything else that is here in relation to the Dhamma is classified as mindlessness. In other words, if I take the notion that I'd be a good Buddhist by being mindful when I'm washing the dishes, I'm no longer practicing the Dhamma, am I? So that is mindlessness as it relates to the Dhamma. There's no Dhamma there. And how does one dwell in mindlessness? When one is unrestrained at the eye, the mind is agitated and distracted by mental fabrications. Do you see how this relates directly to dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths? From ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications. From fabrications, through that sequence, we come in contact with the sixth sense base, and that's a preview of what's to come. This sutta, like many others, but not all, you can see the tight relationship between this and dependent origination. When agitated and distracted, there is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. It's what I was just saying. If I'm practicing some kind of concept of what a good Buddhist or a good awakened person might do, or a good American, it's just a concept of that, isn't it? There's no real foundation, and that's what it's lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma. It might be something that we feel is beneficial because of who might have told us that, or our associations that have found it helpful to be mindful when you're washing the dishes. Or maybe just it's innovative and novel, a romantic notion of actual Dhamma practice. But it's lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma. And that's why it doesn't work. When that is done, the Buddha says, there is no serenity. There's constant grasping after. And if you think about that, and I keep using this one example of being mindful when you're washing the dishes, but it applies to everything. If I'm grasping after the notion that I must be mindful of washing the dishes for my own salvation, there's no serenity in that, is there? The only serenity that might come is when I'm done washing the dishes and I feel like I've done something good for myself, when the truth of the matter is I distracted myself, at least in that period of time, from actually practicing the Dhamma and incorporating right view in what is occurring. Is that clear with everyone? If anyone's not clear on that point, just open your mic and just tell me. Okay. The Buddha continues, in that case, my words there is only disappointment and distraction. When we're not joyfully engaged in, with the Dhamma, there's only disappointment and distraction. And what joyful engagement, another word for that that we often use is rapture. It's an archaic word, but it does not mean the second coming. Most people apply it that way. Rapture means a joyful, almost and a standing in awe engagement with what's occurring. So rapture as it relates to the Dhamma is full emotion, full joyful immersion, I meant, full joyful engagement with the Dhamma. We're joyfully engaged with the Dhamma because we know the benefits of actual Dhamma practice. We've taken true refuge. We understand the benefits of it. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. When one dwells unrestrained over the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, or the mind is then agitated and distracted. Do you see how that relates directly to the, I think it's the 6th to 7th factors of dependent origination? There is no joyful engagement with a Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with a Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Again, the Buddha is reminding us, and this relates, and the reason why these are back-to-back, this relates directly to last week's teachings on the importance of jhana meditation. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. In that moment that we concentrate the mind by taking a breath, that's Dhamma practice. And so you've heard me say this in certain different ways. It is at the point of contact. It's at as life occurs that we practice the Dhamma. And so we cannot practice the Dhamma if we're distracted out of this moment, can we? That's the importance of jhana meditation. So we're simply present in our bodies for our life as our life occurs. And then, in that case, in that well-concentrated case, then we can apply the Dhamma. If we can't achieve that state of concentration, there is no possibility for developing the Dhamma because the Dhamma can only be developed in the present moment, in life as life unfolds. That's clear with everyone, I hope. Okay. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. When one dwells unrestrained of thoughts, the mind is agitated and distracted by ideological fabrications. There is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. By ideological fabrications, which is simply sacred cows, the belief systems that we hold, whether it's individual or collective societal sacred cows. And a sacred cow is anything that if challenged will shatter my view of who I am in relation to the world. And so we cling to all of these fabricated beliefs. And we feel safe in our distraction when we're able to create the ownership of these collective fabrications. We think we're doing okay, whatever that might be, and it's different for everyone. But it's fabricated. It's removed from the Dhamma. It's just a distraction. And so you've heard me say over and over again that a mind rooted in ignorance is never living their life. The Buddha refers to that as a death-like state. So we join with our own life in our life as our life occurs through the Dhamma. That's the brilliance of what the Buddha taught. He taught us a method of taking a mind disjoined from its body, constantly distracted by self-referential views, by fabricated views, and through this brilliant and simple Eightfold Path, we reunite our minds with our body and we get to live our life as our life occurs, which is the only way we can have a human life, right here, right now. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction, constantly grasping after what is fulfilling to me. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. The Buddha reiterates that over and over again. The primary aspect of developing the Dhamma is concentration. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. This is how one dwells in mindlessness. Applying the mind or holding principles in mind that have nothing to do with the Dhamma and only lead to distraction. And how does one dwell in mindfulness? When a Dhamma practitioner dwells in restraint with the eye, with the nose, with the ear, with the tongue, with the body, and then the mind is not agitated or distracted by mental fabrications. Practicing restraint at the sixth sense base. And how do we practice restraint at the sixth sense base? by being well concentrated and mindful that this is what's occurring, that I am coming in contact with external phenomena, and I can either interpret it through a mind rooted in ignorance, or I can inform myself about what's occurring from a mind rooted in understanding of life, of human life. And in that moment, I'm not taking whatever is occurring personally, and my mind is not reacting or becoming distracted by what's occurring. And that rest in understanding what's occurring. Of course, the only way that I can understand what's occurring is to be present for what's occurring. It makes perfect sense, but it needs to be said, because a mind rooted in ignorance is constantly distracted away from that. There is joyful engagement with the Dhamma. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity. There is contentment. The Dhamma is the Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. Moment by moment, they dwell in mindfulness. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated. So instead of a self-referential ego's need to compulsively grasp after every thought that occurs simply because it's my thought, we learn, and we've all experienced this, that quieting of the mind through jhana meditation in the framework of the Eightfold Path. We don't as compulsively grasp after every one of my thoughts. We're becoming more reflective of thoughts and more realistically evaluating the value of our own thoughts. We're recognizing ignorance now, and we're able to recognize it and simply abandon it because of the structure we've developed within our own minds through the Eightfold Path. Well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated or distracted by ideological fabrications. There is joyful engagement with the Dhamma. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity. There is contentment. The Dhamma is present. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. The Buddha is describing the quality of mind of mindfulness. It's a non-distracted quality of mind. It's a mind that is resting in serenity. Another word we use for that is equanimity, that fourth level of jhana, or that present level of an awakened human being. This is how one dwells in mindfulness. It's the end of that brief sutta. Thank you. So there can be no confusion at all about what the Buddha means by mindfulness to someone who is actually studying the Dhamma. But you can see, if you don't have the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, we will apply it in a very haphazard way, because we think that's a good thing to do. We should be mindful of dishes, the car, our feet when we're walking, etc., etc. But without the foundation of the Eightfold Path, that's a cruel thing to tell someone. To tell someone who cannot concentrate their mind well enough to do the task, that they should do the task and that makes them somehow a better person. It's just hurtful. And when it doesn't work, then the harsh judgment is, well, this Buddhist teaching is a bunch of nonsense, or at least it doesn't work for me. When the problem is, you're simply not practicing Buddhism, you're practicing something else. All right, let's go around the room. I'm going to start with Ram this morning. Ram, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
The funny thing is, after our discussion beforehand on political matters, I was going back and say, okay, where is the Dhamma here? Where is right mindfulness in this? And I'm still mulling on that. Last night, Anita had me listen to something that she was very much interested in the spiritual realm. And it was so completely out of the Dhamma that I had a hard time giving her a mindful reaction to that. But to apply mindfulness in everyday life and still be it within the Dhamma can be challenging.
Yeah, it certainly takes practice and continued right effort, doesn't it?
Right.
It's not, there's nothing magic. I can't just decide that I'm going to be a Dhamma practitioner and everything is resolved within my own mind. But you made a reference to the political climate and how does refined mindfulness apply to that? And ultimately, refined mindfulness is being at peace with whatever is occurring. But it doesn't mean that we don't have a perspective on what's occurring. It doesn't mean we lose the ability for critical thinking. It simply means we radically accept what's occur, even though we may not agree with everything. And that's how we maintain a mind of equanimity, of serenity.
Yeah.
So even the Buddha did that. There's many stories of the Buddha advising people in a certain way.
Right.
But it wasn't because of an ideological position. It was because it reflects the Dhamma. So just to make the point, if President Trump called me and said, what do you think I should do? I don't expect that call, by the way. But if he said, what do you think I should do? I would probably give him an unexpected answer. But it would be based on what I understand of the Dhamma. You know, and that view doesn't make it right or wrong in the world. It's simply my view. It might be a view informed by the Dhamma, but that does not mean that anybody else should adopt it or that a political party should adopt it just because it's a Dhamma. That's ridiculous thinking. And I know you're not saying that. What I'm trying to explain is we can develop a common peaceful mind no matter what's occurring in the world, even something like this. It's the point of the Dhamma, isn't it? This is just an ordinary aspect of dukkha. It might be, the world might be reacting with a lot more fear now, but it's still part of dukkha. It's still described as the first noble truth, and we understand it because we understand the nature of ignorance and suffering. Thank you, Ram. Let's go to Brett. Brett, how are you this morning?
I'm good. Thank you for the sutta. I can definitely see how, like you said, the only way you can practice this is in the present moment as life unfolds.
Yeah.
And it's the only way you can practice the Dharma. So if you're caught in your head, that you're not really, it's impossible to practice it. But good to be here. Thank you for your teaching.
Yeah, thank you. It makes sense, doesn't it, Brett?
Yeah.
Michael, how are you? Good morning.
Hi, John. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. All right. So as I understand what you're saying here, like, let's go back to just doing the dishes. Okay. So it's, you do your task throughout the day, but you're non-reactionary to what might be occurring as you're doing them. And nothing is personal, and you don't get distracted by what you're doing, but you're able to do what you're doing, but you're not distracted by what you're doing.
Yep. Yeah, that's the essence of the Dhamma. And so I develop concentration on my cushion. I develop refined mindfulness through integrating the Eightfold Path, and then I take that quality of mind to the dishes. And so I'm naturally mindful of, not mindful of doing the dishes, I'm naturally mindful, period. The dishes or the walking or the car or anything else has no bearing on my mindfulness. My activity has no bearing on the level of my mindfulness. Because I've established it outside of the activity. You know, that's a significant difference between what the Buddha taught and modern applications of mindfulness. So, very good analysis, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, John.
Julia, how are you this morning?
Good morning, John. I'm good. Thank you. Well, I have one thing to say. I was looking at my notes, and I think this is called the Yamakavaga Sutta.
Yamakavaga.
How do you say it, John?
Yamakavaga.
The Yamakavaga. Oh, Yamakavaga. How did you say it?
Yamakavaga.
My mind is not good. But the one thing I remember from that, and I wrote down this quote from the Buddha, was the quality of the mind precedes all mental states. Mind is the governing principle. So you can see here that the reflective quality of the mind, is rooted in ignorance and wrong view. Of course, it's going to cause mental fabrications and unravel itself.
Yeah.
But if the mind is at peace, then of course now its reflective quality is now its awareness. It's self-aware, and it acts in a positive, right view manner. So I like the sutta because I like at the end how the Buddha gives you the quality of the mind, how we dwell in mindfulness, and how he presents the whole that whole paragraph there, where he tells you how the mind is supposed to be when it's that way.
Yeah.
Instead of always, you know, the negative. This, at least this is something that we can attain, you know.
Thank you, Julie. And that's an important point. Does anybody feel they can't develop this type of mindfulness? No, I mean, there's nothing extraordinary about it. It doesn't even take all that great of an effort. It just takes the focus rooted in jhana meditation to do this.
John, the thing that I like also is that it's like an awareness. Like I feel myself sometimes. I can see that when I've lost my mind.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it happens many times a day, but at least I can like fish it back, you know, and reel it back in again, you know, because I'm actually more aware now. Now practicing the Dharma, I'm actually more aware of the quality of my mind almost constantly, which is really good.
Yeah, that's incredible. And again, that's kind of the whole point, isn't it? That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Notice the quality of your mind. That's what you just said. You're able to do that. That's you could call that dwelling in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, because you're able to apply the teachings at that deep and subtle level. And that's not, but I would, Julie, it's, as you're doing it, it's completely ordinary, isn't it? Because you own it, is what I'm saying. It's nothing, there's nothing extraordinary about this. It's a completely human experience, which is what's so remarkable about it.
It's natural.
Yeah. There's nothing magical, mystical, esoteric, or even special about it, except as it relates to ignorance. It's all it is. It's just becoming human. So, thank you, Julia. Becky, how are you this morning?
Hi, everyone. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Thank you. I really, basically, Julia just said everything that I was thinking. The end of the sutta that really tells you sort of how to do it.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, nice sutta. I think, of course, mindfulness is the total foundation, and you can never be reminded too often what mindfulness is and how you can develop it at point of contact. I still say that it is not an easy task. I often have trouble reeling things back, as Julia mentioned. But at least you can recognize many times throughout the day when you have lost your mind. And I find myself thinking more and more about what is the state of my mind. It sort of comes into, you know, you like, and I guess that is mindfulness.
Yes.
And if I can take a little bit more time, I have a little question, because I want to make sure that my understanding is correct. I think it is, but I'm looking at the 12, the dependent origination 12 links.
Mm-hmm.
And the first three, from ignorance as a requisite condition, come fabrications. From fabrications comes consciousness. Now, could you replace consciousness with identity? From fabrications as a requisite condition comes identity, or comes self-identity. Is that sort of what you mean by consciousness?
No, because that's addressed in three or four more steps. Nama rupa, name and form, is self-reference. But look at the progression from a mind rooted in ignorance, becomes a fabricated way of looking at the world that feeds your thinking. But it is the distinction that's important is it's your thinking that creates the self-reference. Because if you just said, your thinking means your identity, then there'd be nothing to change, would it? There'd be no way to change our thinking because it'd be rooted in that. It's our thinking that we actually do change. It's that consciousness that goes
so
from...
Another word for consciousness would be our thinking.
Yes, thinking rooted in ignorance in the beginning stages of Dhamma practice. But it is that same mind that awakens. There's nothing externally applied or developed.
Okay.
Within that human being. But again, it's such an important point that you bring up. It's not our thinking that... How do I say this? It's our thinking that's the problem that leads to self-reference, self-grasping.
Okay.
But it's that same mind that releases and abandons self-reference and grasping after.
Okay. So from conscious comes consciousness. So in other words, that condition from fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. That's a consciousness rooted in ignorance.
Yes.
Okay.
And then look at the rest of the links where that type of thinking leads you to.
Yeah, a consciousness rooted in ignorance. Yes.
Yes.
That type of thinking leads you then to name and form, to I'm the most important thing in the world.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and look at the progression from, I think it's consciousness to feeling to contact.
Right, the rest of the progression is, I think, very clear. I can see it. It's unfolding. It's just that I was just stuck right there at the beginning.
Yeah, it's such an important point, Becky.
Consciousness is such a huge, it's so all-encompassing. Consciousness, but you have
well
to
it is it's the whole issue it's our thinking that holds the space for ignorance, isn't it, by insisting
yes.
that I remain
yep.
ignorant and yes. so that's the brilliance of what Siddhartha Gautama awakened to, and so that's what he addressed. He
yeah.
wasn't concerned about being mindful again washing the dishes. He was concerned about being mindful of reality, of true human existence, and to understand the process that I engage with to keep myself distracted and suffering so that I can reverse it, not so some external force or my belief alone will change it. I have to do the work. I have to change my consciousness, my thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
it's another difficult word at times, because in the last maybe 50 years we've taken the word consciousness and made it something cosmic or something that we're all part of this grand cosmic consciousness. And
right.
and I'm saying the last 50 years, but that was common also during the Buddha's time. And he said, that's nonsense. We're not part of some grand cosmic consciousness. What we have to deal with is a consciousness that's rooted in ignorance. And that is collective, but it's not connected.
Thank you. That helps a lot. I mean, I have to think about it some more, but that helps a lot.
Yeah, your question helped us a lot. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
John, can I just ask a question
yes.
now that Becky said that?
Please.
So is consciousness supposed to be like the state of mind then? That's consciousness, right?
It certainly contributes to your state of mind. But that fourth foundation of mindfulness, the present quality of your mind, changes as your consciousness changes. Consciousness is the most malleable thing in the world if we let it be so. Or it can be the most rigid thing in the world. Look out on the world today. So consciousness, like everything else about me as an individual human being, is up to me. There's nothing imposed on me except the conditioning of the world, but that's still my responsibility, isn't it? So if I'm finding some aspects of my thinking that are disappointing to me, I now have the wherewithal and the effective practice to change that thinking in a realistic way, something that's going to have actual benefit to me as a human being. I'm not just applying another feel-good concept because now I find that washing the dishes no longer works for me. So let me try walking meditation. And I'll do that for 3 weeks, and now that's no longer satisfying. So let me try chanting. And chanting doesn't work, so let me try praying. You never get anywhere, do you? Because you're always disappointing yourself by your own thinking. Or you develop something that actually brings benefit and focus, and you're no longer disappointing yourself. You find joyful engagement with the Dhamma because it's actually working. It's changing the way you think. It's changing your consciousness. And it's changing your consciousness because it's undoing that link from ignorance to fabrications. You're no longer feeding your fabricated mind by ignorance. You're now introducing the wisdom of understanding, and so the fabrications are gone, and the wisdom is now informing your consciousness, which interrupts the entire chain. Kevin?
John, you just said something really neat there, but you said consciousness can be the most rigid thing in the world, and you know, I would ask the Sangha, why is that? Why can it be the most rigid thing in the world, and why is it? You know, what John was just talking about.
All right, I'll ask you first, then. Why?
Because of ignorance.
Because of ignorance. That's what I was
going to
say.
And it's alive, and it's in the moment, literally the most dynamic thing that we can probably come in, that we have, is because of empty ignorance, as we...
Yes, emptiness, ignorance.
Yeah, I just thought that was cool to bring that up.
It's also closely tied to our, you know, to ourself, which we rigidly defend.
It is ourself. And then when I talk about the powerful and subtle strategies that we all create to maintain ignorance, that's what I'm talking. That's what Kevin's talking about. It's what we're all talking about. We become very, very rigid in our own beliefs about who we are in relation to the world. And once we adopt that, we're compelled to defend it, at least until we have to admit that it no longer works for us. But for most people, that's the deathbed. And again, so we spend our whole lives defending these ideological views of ourself in relation to the world, and we've just lost our entire life. Remember our study last summer. Those 37 classes put the focus on just this, what we're talking about. Right here, in my mind and in my body as my life is unfolding, is where I can liberate my consciousness from that. But of course, it has to be there. My problem isn't that I'm not mindful of washing the dishes. My problem is I'm not mindful of what and who I am in relation to the world. And again, I don't mean to keep beating that one idea up. It's just a common one. So the Buddha taught this very, very gentle way, and it is gentle, by joyfully engaging in something that's going to resolve all of our issues about ourselves in relation to the world. It's going to end not knowing. And it's a direct... it's a direct ending to that. We have an experience of understanding. Great question and great discussion. Thanks, Becky. Tom, how are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Good to see you this morning.
Thanks. The only question I have at the moment is to ask you if you can spell the name of that sutra. I need to go back to do a little review.
Which one? The Yamakavaga?
Oh, is that the one?
Is that, that's part of the Dhammapada? It's Yamakavagga.
Okay.
Yamakavaga. Yeah, if you go on the website, or even through the email, look up the Dhammapada. I think it's chapter 18, but that's a huge guess. I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah, I really like the talk, or the commentary, your commentary on the sutta. My head was swimming, so I haven't gotten that far. But one thing that struck me is when you mentioned that it's only what happens in the moment that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
Which is obvious once somebody says it, or once you realize it.
Yeah, but we do it to ourselves. We're so distracted to the past and the future. It's obvious, but it's almost surprising when we hear it. But yeah, of course I have to be present with life as life occurs if I'm going to live it.
Right.
It is. It's so obvious. The entire Dhamma is obvious, but because of a mind rooted in ignorance and prone towards distraction, it simply can't see it. But what Julie said, she's describing coming to the ordinary understanding of the Dhamma. Because once we integrate, okay, it's just life. There's nothing extraordinary about it. Thank you, Tom. I'm glad you joined us this morning.
Thank you.
Who's down there? Is that Liz? Hello, Liz.
Hi, John. Hi, everyone. It's good to be here.
Good to see you.
It was a good sutta, and it's a good reminder of, you know, preventing us from losing our minds, particularly under the circumstances. So I appreciate what everyone said, and you know, sometimes our default buttons are so strong. But this is just a reminder that there's a way to move away from that. So I will endeavor to persevere.
Thank you, Liz. Yeah, there certainly is a way of moving away from desperation and fear. It's through the Dhamma. So. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, everybody.
How are you?
Good. You can indulge me for 1 minute.
Sure.
Because everybody said some really interesting things. On that idea, if I could just revisit the pursuit of origination to what Becky and Julia were saying. I take it as consciousness, as that requisite condition, is when the moment the mind becomes aware of itself, in that moment, name and form pops up as a requisite of consciousness. So the moment the mind becomes aware of itself, you now identify.
If it's rooted in ignorance, yes.
Rooted in ignorance, of course, yep. as the requisite. So I don't know if that clears it up. Rather than going down a rabbit hole of consciousness and unconsciousness and subconsciousness and all these mystical realms, how I look at it is the moment through ignorance the mind becomes aware of itself in the world.
Yeah, that's why we avoid talking about subconsciousness and mystical realms, because it's just a distraction.
And, you know, it's interesting, too. In the Sutta, you know, that we read over today, you know, the Buddha, every single time after he speaks, mentions, states, warns us, says to us that when the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. And I'm taking that as him, as Buddha saying, moment to moment, when you are distracted, you will lose the Dhamma. And it's in that distraction where that dependent origination flourishes.
Yep.
And I think, you know, other thing too, you know, politics are also ideological fabrications.
Yep.
If you think about it. So it's a big distraction. And this isn't to anybody here, but this is just my observations, is that by just separating from it, because it becomes ideological and it's a fabrication and it is a big distraction and you lose your mind in it. And I was reading over the week, John, and this has to do with what we're talking about. I was reading another source, you know, I've read your books, of course, but I was also reading Bhikkhu Bodhi's book on the Pali Canon. And he discussed his interpretation when he was discussing the wheel of the Dhamma, how when the Buddha became enlightened on the Four Noble Truths. And I thought this was really interesting, and I just wanted your take on this. And I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but basically the perception of the three perceptions of the wheel of the Dhamma, that the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is to be fully understood. The second truth, the truth of suffering's origin or craving, is to be abandoned. And the third truth, the truth of cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth truth, the truth of the path, is to be developed. And you've said that too in a different way, but that's where it is, right? I mean, that development.
Yeah, I've said it exactly that way.
You know, and that's, you know, and we talked about in the last few classes, I mean, I was struggling with acceptance. And, you know, being able to understand and being able to know, but not being able to accept. So this is the development process of that noble truth. And so this sutta kind of helped tie all these linear things together for me. So I appreciate everybody's input.
Thank you, Tim. Really, really good analysis and input from you. I will say, when you're reading anybody, you mentioned Bhikkhu Bodhi. You have to understand where they're coming from and what their associations are. So I think Bhikkhu Bodhi is one of the brilliant modern Buddhist writers, especially translators of the Pali Canon. but his lineage is, and there are many of them, he's a member of a few major monasteries. One of them is right here in New Jersey, up in Lafayette. And their charge is to unite all the different Buddhist traditions into one, or at least present them in one setting. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations have always been with that collective, marrying all of Buddhism together. And so you can read that in his writings. And that's just to be understood. I'm not knocking him. But he does diverge from what the Buddha actually taught because of that external influence. But I've yet to find any good writer who even with Thanissara Bhikkhu, it's obvious to me his Theravadan and Abhidhamma influence in his writings. But that doesn't mean they're not useful. You just have to know what you're looking for. And you have to be able to separate out what the Buddha likely taught to what translators put into the Dhamma to fit their own views. But that's just common. That's always going on. You know. Thank you, Tim. Is that Mary next to you there? Mary Allen? Is that you? Yeah. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
There you are.
Good morning. Wonderful sutta. I think the commentary has been rich and enlightening. I don't think I really have anything else to add. I of course, love what Liz said. You know, I will endeavor to persevere. I guess I feel the same way today. So thank you for the teaching, Tom.
Thanks for joining, Mary. Kevin.
Hey, everybody. Good to see you, John. You know, there's just something that I have to say, or it's just because it's applicable. We were talking about the example of the dishes and doing the dishes and doing tasks and, you know, sort of the murkiness there. But I think all of us know that we cultivate jhana and the four foundations on our cushion and, you know, throughout our lives and our tasks, when we're able to return to the sensation of breathing, like John said, we're bringing our focus back to the breath. It's interesting in the current times how pop culture likes to take these concepts, like John's saying, and everything's a mindful, like, you know, we just go to the grocery store mindfully and, you know, literally, like, probably in the last 48 hours, this new one's come out with the pop culture thing, and it's this virtue signal, which is I wear a mask and I'm a virtue signaler. And if we can, in this context of this conversation, we can see right now the distraction and the ignorance just in that activity. All of us in this room practice the Dhamma, we meditate, maybe we go to the grocery store and we may put on a mask in the current climate. And I think that all of us are actually mindfully wearing a mask because it's a thing we do. We go to the grocery store calmly, we wear a mask and we leave. But these other folks that are trying to mindfully wear a mask and virtue signal are actually perpetuating ignorance, as we can see. That's a strategy to reinforce it if we've ever seen it. So I just thought that was very curious that, you know, now we're doing good. We're real heroes if we wear masks, and there's just a distorted consciousness, as we just talked about with all of that. So just a little digression there. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing it up. We'll create self-identities over anything and make ourselves great for doing it, won't we? I'm wearing a mask. And
yes.
Those are, when your ego gets that big because you're doing something that's just reasonable, those are the ones that usually yell at everyone else if they happen to forget their mask.
Right, you know? Right.
I went to the store the other day and I put a mask on, but my motivation and intention was I'm doing it because I don't want other people to become fearful of me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really the reason. Let me do my part to contribute to a little bit of peace at the Frenchtown Market for a few minutes.
But I want to remain calm and wear a mask so I don't get harassed by somebody.
Well, I don't. I mean, I get harassed all the time, especially here. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I've lost that motivation a long time ago. I guess if you're going to be a Dhamma teacher, you
right.
get used to being harassed at times. No, it really is that. I don't want to contribute to somebody's disturbed state of mind by instilling right. fear because I don't have a mask on.
And that's... You know? That's like,
I don't necessarily think it's going to save my life, but it might, you know?
Yeah. But that's coming from the point of wisdom of Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's sensible to do that right now.
Yeah, I would mention it to Ram. I would, if when this whole thing happened, if they said everybody over 60 has to stay home until we tell you otherwise, but we're going to let the rest of the world live, especially children, I would have said, fine, I'll stay in my house for 20 years if they can stop locking up children for their spring and summer. You know, because that's, I think that, now I'm getting into the political. I'm just saying that's what I thought would have been the best response. I know that I'm in trouble if I go out because of my age and some of the things I got going on with me. I shouldn't be out in the world today, but other people should be. And the, you know, that's just, again, getting back to what I said, that's the way that I see it. I'm not saying it should be that way. It's the way that I see it. That was my response when it first happened. I don't want kids locked up because of me, because I could get sick. That's ridiculous. But thank you, Kevin. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning, John. Morning, everyone. I think coming to class works, because there are actually many times in a day sometimes that I'm just aware that I'm feeling a feeling, or thinking a thought, I should say. And it's just something that's currently there with me.
Yeah.
And the more you think and the more aware of feelings that you are, you can't not notice impermanence. And impermanence is so vital to understanding your thoughts and understanding your feelings. To me, now, impermanence is so sort of fundamental to my life. It's almost like understanding gravity or something. You just know it's there. You just know it. And so that always helps, whatever thoughts we get caught up in, maintaining our ignorance. Whatever feeling we get caught up in, which is maintaining our ignorance, is temporary.
Yeah.
And you can always just fall back. If you do nothing else, you can always fall back that, you know, in 5 minutes' time, it's not going to mean anything to me. Yeah. And that's a great help is to look at what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, and it's all impermanent. It's just a fabrication that my mind is on at this moment. And so I often lump that together that, and to understand fabrications a little bit more, that a few weeks ago, somebody mentioned the word enslaved. We enslave ourselves with what we think we are. And I just love that word, that I can see I am enslaving myself to my own specific thoughts of what I think this moment is, or making a judgment on something, or however my mind goes. And I just love that word, that we just enslave ourselves.
Yeah.
And through the Dharma, through your teachings, through the Buddha teachings, that we can just see. It just opens the window to watch, you know, to all that you've talked about this morning. And it starts off when you start learning all this stuff, there seems to be a very fine line between a thought rooted in reality and a thought rooted in ignorance. It seems to be a fine line, but it gets clearer. It gets clearer as you practice and you get more experienced in practicing, more experienced in listening to the talks. It gets clearer, and having that clearer definition, you can make in the day-to-day life. You can come to the right judgment quicker. And it's not so profound. It's just like, okay, you know, I'm thinking this and I'm getting caught up in this thought. I'm feeling this and I'm getting caught up in this feeling. Oh, hang on. It's not there. it's just my own fabrication, and I've just developed all this stuff in my mind. And I think you go through day to day life a little bit more calmer. Thank you.
Thank you, Lorna. That was outstanding. I think that was the Magavabhanga Sutta where I mentioned that we enslave ourselves, and we literally do that. And our master then is our own ignorance. You know, that's what keeps us in it. That really was wonderful. Wait, you're getting right to the heart of it. Ram gave you a very special bowl a couple of weeks ago for a certain reason, and you deserve it. Thank you. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. As usual, I enjoyed the Sutta and got my mind spinning again. I think the key for me to try to understand all this is understanding distraction. And for me, it seems the biggest distractor that I have in my life is kind of a generic fear about a lot of things.
Yep.
Either I'm not going to get what I want, or I'm going to lose what I have. And it even applies itself to the Dhamma. I fear I may not get it. So I can kind of go round and round on this. The thing that is kind of sustaining to me are the brave souls here who are willing to really look at what it means to become a human. And it takes courage.
Sure it takes
I don't know if I have it or not. I hope I do.
You're here.
I'm here. I'm trying.
Yeah.
But those are my thoughts this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, they're very skillful thoughts and understanding. You remember the first class we had in this series where in the Loka Sutta, where the Buddha says where there's desire, there's fear. So when we really understand that craving after, then we can look at, well, what am I, if I'm fearful, what am I desiring in this moment? What's generating the fear? And you'll find it's always wanting something to be different than it is, whether it's more of something or less of something. But that's what generates fear. Fear is finding fault with the future. So we think something's going to happen that's going to take something away from me that I think I need. And when we start addressing that, and I'm going to use the word addressing, when we start recognizing, which is really what everybody's talking about, and abandoning the underlying cause, the desire, fear just slips away. It's no longer present because there's no longer desire motivating it. And you're describing that wonderfully well, Josh. So, I do think that people that actually develop the Dhamma are probably the most courageous people in the world because they're actually willing to look at themselves in a realistic way. You know, not some pop psychology way of putting on a different robe, but really getting down and recognizing these are the things that I did to myself that caused so much greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Let me change it. Let me do the work. That takes a lot of courage, you know. And I'll agree with you. We're all very courageous people. So, thank you, Josh. Kevin, how are you? It's good to see you this morning. Kevin Roach. Kevin! I can't unmute your mic, Kevin. Can you, Dr. Kevin?
Yeah, am I unmuted now?
Yep.
Yeah, good. I thought I was before. Sorry. Thank you. Gosh, it gets deeper and deeper. I love those comments that Josh just made about fear and courage. And the whole discussion just brings us back to the 12 links of dependent origination. But I have, and I just wanted to circle back to the comment about politics, and then I had a question too. But you know, with politics, I'm not sure, and I'm kind of maybe probably misquoting the Buddha, but Buddha talks about, you know, having talk of kings and thieves and armies and ancestors, and even I think he says the low talk of the marketplace.
Yeah.
And these are all distractions. They're there. I mean, we're forced to confront them in our daily lives. But I think we need to, if we have the Dhamma, then maybe we can face these things with more equanimity.
Yeah.
They are a distraction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of the point of the Dhamma, so we don't lose our minds in any situation. So.
Yeah. And then my question, too, is, I mean, just the, I think, you know, with modern mindfulness, it gets off on a tangent about this, is the importance of the four postures, because I think Buddha does talk about these, if I'm not mistaken, in the Satipatthana Sutta. I am going, I am standing, I am sitting, I am lying down. And in mindfulness, he exhorts us to be aware of these four postures.
But not as a practice, and that's the problem.
Yeah,
many people take lying down as some type of meditation or mindfulness practice. When the Buddha's just teaching, if you're lying down, you should know that you're lying down and not be walking around in your mind, you know?
Yeah, and the same as maybe washing the dishes, you're aware that you're doing it, but it's not practice. Yeah,
well, and even in the Satipatthana Sutta, he's teaching the results of practice, you know?
Yes.
It's an important point. That you're making the point better than I did. So thank you.
Thank you. Never. Thanks.
Good to see you. Laura, how are you this morning? There you are. Good morning.
Good morning. I think that this has been such a lovely discussion, and everyone's comments have kind of touched upon the aspects of the Four Noble Truths and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and Dependent Origination. And I think that the sutta is really focused on the, you know, practice of meditation and mindfulness and the Eightfold Path. And the difference between telling yourself you're going to do something that you're kind of grasping at that as having a particular result, and just, you know, going about your day as it unfolds in your present moment mindfulness. I just really loved everyone's comments and
me too.
Thoughts, and, you know, this idea of fear as being really this really strong emotion that I think causes so much of kind of getting entrapped in not recognizing the Four Noble Truths through that, you know, through fear. You kind of can lose sight of that, but recognizing that that's just an aspect of our suffering here. The idea that Lorna brought of impermanence, and, you know, that, you know, recognizing that can kind of pull you out of your, you know, fabrications and limited, enslaved consciousness that's not flexible. It's wonderful group. I'm so grateful every time I show up to everyone's well-concentrated sangha here. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us, Laura. It really is remarkable, the level of understanding that we've all developed, and that leads to such a skillful discussion. We really have become all teachers of the Dhamma, all of us. You know, I guess our newest member is probably Josh, and what he said about fear and desire is fear and courage is just remarkable. But all of you, the discussion and how easily we use the phrase now, lost our minds. That's only recently that, as a sangha, we've become comfortable saying what is obvious. I've been saying it for years because that's how I teach. But it shows that we're really developing a true understanding that it's okay to lose your mind. It's something that I can accept, that I do it. And now we realize that we do it all the time, don't we? And so what? Because we have... It'd be awful to learn that we've lost our mind and we have no way of getting it back, wouldn't it? But we lose our minds all the time. We recognize it and we take a breath and we have our minds back again. It is remarkable. It reminds me of a friend I had, and I might have mentioned this, many, many years ago. He was a Jesuit. Brother Kenny was really, at the time, he was one of my best friends. I still is. We haven't seen him in many years. And he had 9 nervous breakdowns. I don't know what you call them today. And he really was one of the most interesting people I've ever met. And he used to have this saying, and he'd say it all the time. He said, it's okay to lose your mind. You just get another one. And we're the living proof of that. It's okay to lose our minds, especially when the minds that we're losing are rooted in ignorance, and get a mind that is rooted in wisdom. And we have this simple eightfold path to do it. Kevin, I'll get to you in a second, but I'd like to hear what Michael has to say.
Oh, John, I had written a poem. I was just going to read it at the end of...
Let's hear it.
A little bit on impermanence, so just to run it by. Okay, I'll take a shot at this. Okay. It's called Days Pass. Days pass like water spilling from a glass as the future becomes the past. So then, what is there but now, you ask? There is but this. This moment and nothing more, and in a moment it too shall pass. For you see nothing, no matter how alluring to the eye or imbued with such great beauty. And no one whom we love or have ever loved or will ever love again more than thyself will forever last. For this heart that beats in this chest will one day draw its final breath, and both will one day forsake this me, this whom I deem to be, for time or so-called by man passes like water spilling from a glass.
That's just beautiful, Michael. Will you send it to me? I'll put it on the website.
Sure.
Great.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Kevin.
Michael, that was beautiful. That was a... an homage to your ancestors. I thought, Lorna, I really liked how you brought out impermanence earlier. I think another cultural nod to you, one of the English contributions to culture is the game of football, and they have a thing called laws of the game. It's almost as if impermanence is a law. You know, it really is that you have to really accept it and acknowledge it, and it helps us do that. Bring back our mindfulness. So I liked how you did that. And I wanted to say one thing to Josh. Josh, you know, you just keep your contributions are showing your Dhamma practice. Like what you said, you're seeing the nuances of distraction. I mean, that is
that's remarkable.
Just, you know, yeah. I mean, your words are showing it. Your Dhamma practice is taking root, my friend. So keep coming, and I love your contribution, so thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. What a wonderful class. I don't want it to end, but I guess it has to. We'll have more conversations. We'll finish with Meta, if there's nothing else. So, We're finding, and I say it often, it's a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. It relates to what Josh just said. It's important to continue to simplify the Dhamma in our own mind, because it is simple. It only seems complicated because of our aversion to actually changing our consciousness, like Becky was referencing before. And it's why I always say to be very gentle with ourselves. And what the Buddha taught here is gentle mindfulness. It's not a grasping after type of mindfulness. And maybe you'll all spend the time to reread this without my commentary. And the reason why I'm saying it is sometimes I understand my commentary can even almost overshadow what the sutta is saying. Especially the last part. Read how gentle the Buddha's instructions are here and how gentle the outcome is of applying right mindfulness. And with that, we'll end with metta. Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And again, these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for an outstanding class this morning. Peace.
Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.